And now it's my privilege to introduce our speaker. I have known Rennell for several years now. She currently is our Georgia Al-Anon Area 11 chairperson, but I've seen her work other positions. She's a very dedicated Al-Anon person, works a program that I admire, works her service work diligently. You know, she has been our delegate. She's been other positions, and I wish I had that much stamina because I know how hard she works at it. So, everyone, I hope you'll welcome Rennell.
I'm Rennell, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon, which includes Al-Ateen.
Hi, Rennell.
Hi, everybody. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come and be with you today and share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to start off by saying, Karen, I think you put a whole new level of anonymity, invisibility. Those of you that were here last night and heard Mike's story, I am a good Al-Anon in that I like to set the record straight. And I've already been asked if I was going to have a rebuttal, and I do. So last night, Mike talked about when we got married out at the Grand Tetons, and he talked about what our wedding vows said based on the Indian culture. So I happen to have a copy of our wedding vows. Now, for those of you that may not have been here last night, what he said was, to the best that I can remember, is that a good Indian warrior will take his squaw into the tent and will shadow her. Okay? Is that pretty close to what y'all heard? Okay. Just want to make sure I was right. Okay, so I'm just going to read a small section of what this says. And it says, all peoples of the world recognize marriage, and there are many common themes in all wedding ceremonies. The ceremonies usually give advice, the do's and don'ts of the culture's collective experience concerning marriage, and a blessing or wish for the best for the couple. With tremendous insight, and yet very simply, an Apache marriage ceremony puts it this way. Now you will feel no rain, for each of you will be shelter for the other. Now you will feel no cold, for each of you will be warmth for the other. Now there is no more loneliness. Now you are two persons, but there is only one life before you. Go now to your dwelling to enter into the days of your life together, and may your days together be good and long upon the earth. Just saying. And so anyway, enough of that. I was born in 1952 in Atlanta, Georgia, to two working parents. My father was a captain on the Atlanta Fire Department, and my mother worked as a bookkeeper for Ivan Allen Company. Some of you may remember Ivan Allen became mayor of the city of Atlanta. My entire family on both sides was full of aunts and uncles, and all of my uncles either worked for the Atlanta Police Department or the Atlanta Fire Department. So, if any of you are familiar with those types of occupations, there is a brotherhood there, and they're very close. Being raised by that, I was the first girl in four generations born on my dad's side of the family. So I had a lot of uncles. My dad had three brothers, and so I was treated kind of special by everybody. Now, I really liked hanging around with my dad, and I really liked hanging around with my granddad. I remember my granddad would take me to the ice cream store, and he would introduce me to people, and he would puff up real big, and he said, "This is my grandbaby," you know, and that always made me feel special. It always made me feel loved and made me feel wanted. I would play checkers with my granddad out on his front porch. Sunday mornings, if my dad wasn't working, I would crawl up in his lap, and he would read me the funnies. And those are some of my fondest memories of that. I had an uncle that he was a school detective, and so he would get us into, by the time I got into high school, he would get us into all the high school football games at no charge. So I was really treated special. My mother, on the other hand, she grew up in an alcoholic family. Her father was a very violent alcoholic, and she believed in strict rules. And everything was black and white. There was no gray. You followed the rules, and if you didn't, there was a price to pay. So my mother, on the weekends, if my dad was working on the weekends, we had to clean house, and she liked to pull this white glove inspection. And you couldn't go out and play until everything was clean, and I hated the weekends. You know, she worked during the week. She wasn't around. I had pretty much freedom. I was a latchkey child before latchkey became a word. And my best friend growing up, her dad had crippling arthritis and was in a wheelchair. And so when we went out to play, he had a whistle, and we had to stay within hearing distance of that whistle because that's how he would call us back in. I had a brother who's 5 years older than I was, and he did not like me. I had interrupted his playpen when I came into the world. He was no longer the favorite child, you know. And he used to get in trouble all the time, and I would watch him, and he would try and he could not lie. I mean, he would try to lie, but he would always get caught at it. So what I learned through that process was how to lie and not get caught. I believe we call that manipulation. And it's where you tell just enough, but you have to make sure there's no witnesses or anything. You know, some of us Al-Anons have been accused or have admitted to wanting to commit homicide. You can't have any witnesses. So, anyway... overall, what I came out of with this was being an overachiever, a people pleaser, and a rule follower. And then on the side, I would sneak around and do those things that I wanted to do. My family, we would travel on the summer vacations. My dad wanted to see the USA, and so we would get in our Chevrolet, and we'd drive across the USA. And during that period of time, we would visit a lot of the national parks. And it was through visiting these national parks that I got a sense of a power within the universe that was very creative, that was very powerful. When I would look into the depths of the Grand Canyon, and then when I would stare up into the snow-capped mountains of the Grand Tetons, I could see the awesomeness of a God of this universe. I also went to church, and there I learned that Jesus loved me. Jesus loves all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white. And so this was my understanding of God. He was powerful, and he was loving. But there was another side of that, and that was if you didn't do what God wanted you to do, you would be punished. He could be a punishing God. Again, that reinforced my people-pleasing, my striving to do whatever you wanted me to do. So at the tender age of 12, there was a family that moved in across the street from us. They had six children, and you can imagine with six kids running around, there was always excitement going on over there. And I loved the excitement. Their parents also drank, and this is the first time I would be exposed to anybody that drank alcohol, because my parents did not drink, and neither did my aunts and uncles. And so I loved going over there. There would be fascinating stories. Y'all heard one last night, I believe. And I was intrigued. And so I would play over there with their daughter, who was a year younger than me. And then one day, her father stole my innocence. And my life changed. And it was at this point that I had to reevaluate this God of my understanding. And what I knew was God was either all-powerful or God didn't love me. He was either not all-powerful or he did not love me. I had seen the power of God through visiting these national parks. So there wasn't a doubt in my mind that he was powerful. And if he was that powerful, and if he loved me, why would he have allowed something like this to happen to me? So in my 12-year-old mind, I decided that God didn't love me. And when God can't love you, how can anybody else love you? This would also become my secret because I would not tell anybody. And when I got into these rooms, what I learned was that we're only as sick as our secrets. And I had a big secret. And this secret, trying to keep it, trying to hide it, trying to keep it covered up, would influence every major decision I made from that point forward. So I got old enough to date, and I started dating. And because certain boundaries had been broken, I did not have the power to say no. And so at the tender age of 16, I became pregnant. Now, back in those days, you couldn't go to school if you were pregnant. So in the 10th grade, after completing the 10th grade, I had to drop out of school. Now, this was an interesting time, you see, because now this shame and guilt that I carried from what had happened to me at 12 years old, I now have brought that same shame and guilt upon the family. And so my parents were good enablers. They needed to cover this up. My dad wanted to cover this up in order to protect my reputation. And so what he did, he went and had a false marriage license drawn up that would indicate that we were married before I would have conceived. And he showed it to all my aunts and uncles. And then they planned a shotgun wedding. And we actually got married. So what I learned from this was that you could change the truth. You could alter the truth. I think that's called lying. I'd already had a little bit of practice at that. And then you convince everybody else to believe the lie. Now, what happens to us in Al-Anon, and we hear this a lot, is that first we hear the lie, then we speak the lie, and then we live the lie. And that was something that was going to repeat itself over and over and over again in my life. That marriage lasted about 2 years, and then we were divorced. And having no education and a daughter to raise, my only option was to move back home with Mom and Dad. And I did not want to be there. So it didn't take me long to come up with another plan. And this is another one of those things that how I'm covering up my secret. So my next plan is I need a man that can support me and my daughter. You know, you set your mind to something, you can make it happen. So I found this man. He was 9 years older than I was. He had a Corvette. He had a brand new Grand Prix. He had a work truck. He had a house. Perfect, right? He could support us. What I failed to look at was there was a for sale sign in the front yard. There was no furniture in the house. And he was in the process of getting his second divorce. But that didn't matter, you know. It didn't take long for that relationship to turn virulent, physically violent, and it was a very abusive relationship. He was the first one to introduce me to bars. And so after a year, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and he was arrested and he went to jail, and I was alone again. So once again, I've got to move back home with Mom and Dad. Now, it was this point that I copped an attitude. And my attitude was, I will never depend on another living soul as long as I live. And with that, I got my GED. I went to work for a major corporation on an entry-level job that through the years I was able to advance up into management. But it was at this point that I was at my brother's house, at his apartment, and there was a swimming pool, and I was in the pool with his girlfriend. We were floating around on rafts. And I looked up, and there he was, the one. He had long blonde hair. I mean, it was in the 70s. He had long blonde hair, dark tan, and he was built like a little Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he was strutting around that pool. Ladies, he was good eye candy. And I had this thought that just went through my mind, and it said, if he flips your raft over, you're going to marry him. And I thought, that's crazy. Well, it wasn't long. Somebody snuck up behind me and flipped my raft over. I came up in these big Arnold Schwarzenegger arms. By the way, my bathing suit top had come off. And he was sitting there admiring the view. And I looked up at him and I said, you don't know what you just got yourself into. He did not hear wedding bells. He did not know he had just proposed marriage to me. We dated for 3 years, and then we decided to get married. Now, we drank a lot. And I'm going to tell you, drinking was fun. You know, we would go out to the bars, we would dance, we would have a good time, and we'd come home. But then slowly over a period of time, we'd go out to the bars, we'd dance, we'd come home, and we'd fight. And then the fighting got worse. And, you know, alcoholism starts off slow. And in the beginning, the drinking is fun. It's like a loop, it's like a social lubricant, you know. You can be around people and laugh and have a good time, but then slowly it starts to turn ugly. And it comes back and it'll bite you in the butt. And we would begin to argue, and the arguments were getting worse and worse. And what we did not know was that we were both suffering from the family disease of alcoholism. I had at this point become concerned about the drinking. And so I asked him, I said, you know, we're drinking a lot. Maybe we ought to cut back. I said, we might, you know, we could become an alcoholic. Him being older and wiser than me, he let me know that you could not become an alcoholic by drinking beer. And I believed him. We continued to do this dance, this fight. And the thing about it is, there was a spirit in our house. And this spirit is called alcoholism. And we were both fighting this invisible enemy. And we started to lash out at one another and say cruel things to one another and blame one another for these things. And I had started becoming the person I did not want to be. I did not even recognize who I was. The laughter had gone out of my life. The joy had been stolen from my eyes. And all I could see was anger and hatred for this man who I had married. You remember, he was the one. And alcoholism had stolen the love between us. His drinking had reached the point, and he would go off on binge drinking. He would disappear 4 and 5 days at a time, and I wouldn't know who he was. I wouldn't know where he was. Excuse me. Wouldn't know where he was. Didn't know who he was either. But and I would sit at home, and there in my loneliness, I felt unloved, unwanted, and alone, and very, very fearful. And the one thing I thought was, why is it? Oh, I forgot one thing. My daughter, who is now a teenager, she's left home also. Because, you see, she couldn't stand her mother. Alcoholic didn't bother her. It was her mother. Because I was the one that when she would get up in the mornings, I would fuss at her. She would stay up late at night. She could not get adequate sleep because we would be screaming at each other in the other room. But in the morning, she would get up, and because I could not control the alcoholic, by golly, I was going to control her. And I would fuss at her, and I would raise Cain at her because she had done simple things like she forgot to brush her teeth. And this is the way this precious child would be sent off to school. And she had had enough, and so she had left home. And it was at this point I sat there, and I was surrounded by four cold, lonely walls. And I thought, what is it about me that those that I love can't stand to be around me? You see, I knew I was sick. I knew something was wrong with me. But I didn't know what it was. Didn't know what it was. And it was at that point that I cried out to a God whom I did not know. And I said two simple words. Help me. That is all it takes to turn our lives around. That surrender. I can't do it anymore. I can't fight this disease anymore. I can't stand who I am anymore. God, help me. And it was at that moment, I did not know it at the time, but it was at that moment that I know today that there was a God up above who reached down and picked me up out of the gutter. Through a series of events, by divine intervention, I walked into the rooms of Al-Anon. You see, I didn't feel worthy. I had this spirit of unworthiness, and I knew I couldn't walk into a church. Because I would be judged. I would be looked down upon. I was not good enough. And God knew I needed a specialist. And so he sent me through the doors of Al-Anon. And when I walked through those doors, I knew for the very first time in my life that I had come home. I had come home to you. And what I knew is because in that welcome that Karen shared with us, it says, you may not know all of us, but you will come to love us the same way we already love you. Talk to each other. Reason things out. But let there be no criticism of one another. Let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. You told me you understood. You told me you understood. And you gave me hope. You gave me hope. So I came into these rooms, and I had basically already worked step one by the time I got here. So now it was about step two. Obviously, I had kind of taken step two because I cried out to a God I did not understand and said, help me. So now I'm at step three. Am I willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? Ooh, that's a biggie. I can turn my will and life over. But I couldn't turn the alcoholic over. I loved him. I knew in my heart that I loved this man. And you tell me that he suffered from a disease, and that disease was alcoholism. And when I understood that he suffered from a disease and that I was suffering from this disease, I knew I wasn't angry at him anymore. I knew that we were both sick. And so I was being told I had to let go and let God. I had to let go of him and give him to God. I didn't trust God. Let's go back to when I was 12 years old. I didn't trust God. And then there was a lady in one of my meetings, and she said, "Renelle, God loves him more than you do." It's what I needed to hear. I was able to let go at that point. I was able to turn him over to the God that I was learning about. I still didn't understand this God. I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And I had a lovely sponsor. She was involved in service work, and she just put me under her wing, and she started carrying me to workshops. She started carrying me to conventions. She started carrying me to district meetings. She started carrying me to assembly. I was like, oh my gosh. But she taught me the importance of carrying this message of hope, and that there's a way to do it, and that I had to learn to work with others. I couldn't be correcting somebody all the time. That I was to listen and learn. I am forever grateful for that lady. So 9 months later, I came home from work. The alcoholic had been out on a 5-day binger. And I came home from work, and he had been on the floor all day long, and he was an alcoholic that, by the way, his name's Dickie. So Dickie had been on his hands and knees, and Robert, I think y'all know him as Doc. He had been on his hands and knees, and he obviously was going through withdrawals, and he got on his hands and knees, and he asked God to help him also. Now, I had a spiritual awakening that took a long time. He had a spiritual experience, because when he asked for God's help, he said immediately he felt the weight of the world lift off his shoulders. And when that weight of the world lifted off his shoulder, his feet got about this high off the ground. And it was over a year before they ever came back down and touched. And I'm going to tell you what, for those of you that are living with new sobriety, that is tough to live with. He dove into this program. He never went into treatment. You see, I had too much pride. That man should have gone into treatment. But he had to dry out on his own because I had too much pride. We both worked for companies that had good insurance and would have paid for him to go into treatment. But I didn't want anybody to know. You see, I was still sick. I was still keeping secrets. And it darn near could have cost him his life. One thing about alcoholism, a person can die coming off of alcoholism. People who do drugs will not die coming off drugs. They will die when they go back to them because they think they can take the same amount they did before. So he very well could have died going through DTs. But I had too much pride. I am so grateful that we have a loving God that watches over us for people that are as ignorant as I was to the effects of this disease. Anyway, he dove into this program. He got a sponsor, started working the steps. We started going to conventions together. Life was good. Y'all know what it's like to come in here. We find ourselves happy, joyous, and free, and it was wonderful. We started going on cruises. I don't know if y'all have heard of cruise without booze. You know, we started doing the fun things that we're taught to do in this program. We started living life. And it was beautiful. And we were a couple who was sponsored by a couple. And so we got to go to a lot of places together with our sponsors and share that time together. And it was really wonderful. We moved from where our home group was. We moved about 60 miles away to where I currently live, which is in Cartersville. And I had gotten a promotion, and I was working in Rome, and he worked at Lockheed. And so he was in Cartersville, was a halfway place. So that's how we ended up there. And our children were grown. They were starting to have babies, so we had grandchildren. You know, the beauty of it is our grandchildren have never seen us in this disease. You know, they've only known us in recovery, and that's a beautiful thing. And so I was working for this company and loved my job, and it was after 9/11, and a lot of companies were changing things, and so I was laid off. And I was too young to quit work, and I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. So, you know, I still had this financial insecurity. And so what I did was I got down on my knees, and I asked my higher power, who by now I had come to start understand a little bit. And I was trusting him, and I asked him, you know, what do I do? What do I do? And, you know, he said, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay, and don't burn bridges. So I worked out my days there. I actually trained the person that was going to replace me. And so I left the company, and it was shortly after that. I'd been gone about a year, and they called me back and wanted me to contract for them. You see, when we don't burn bridges, when we do the next right thing, good things happen. So I go back to work with them. I have full retirement, full benefits, insurance, everything. And now they're going to pay me as a contractor, so I'm actually making more money per hour than I was when I worked for them, because I don't have vacation and sick leave and that sort of thing. So now I got two salaries coming in. And so things are good, and I'm contracting back. And so we were in the middle of a big project. And Dick had retired by this time, and he was home. And things just weren't quite right. And he had not been feeling good for about 2 weeks. And this one particular day, I came home, and our trash was sitting at the end of the driveway. Now, since he was retired, when we put the trash out on pickup day, as soon as the garbage man came, he would bring it back into the house. He didn't want it sitting out there. He also he belonged to a bass fishing club with Mike, and they were supposed to have a meeting that night. And so he always went to those. And I got home, and he had not left to go to the meeting. Trash can sitting at the end of the driveway. He hadn't been feeling good for 2 weeks. I thought, oh my gosh, has he had a heart attack? You know? And I run upstairs, and there he sits in his recliner, and he simply said, I don't feel good. And I said, what's the matter? He said, I just don't feel good. And he said he had been sick, you know, he had thrown up, and this man is somebody who never got sick. Even drinking, rarely did he throw up. I don't know how he did that, but anyway. So I took his temperature, and he did not have a fever, and that didn't make sense to me. And so I told him, I said, I think we need to go to the emergency room. And he said, no, I'm going to be fine. And I looked at him, and I said, no. I said, you either let me take you to the emergency room, or I'm calling an ambulance because you're scaring me. And so he agreed to go, and we went to the emergency room, and he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and it had metastasized and gone to the brain, and he had 4 tumors on the brain. And they gave him 4 months to live without treatment. And an average of 16 months with treatment. So I had never had experience up close with cancer, didn't know what it looked like, didn't know the symptoms, didn't know anything, didn't know what to expect. Scared to death because the brain was affected. So I left him in, they got him in a room, and I left him there, and I went home, and I got down on my hands and knees. And once again, I cried out. And I prayed to the God of my understanding. I was at step one again. I was powerless. There was a disease attacking our family, and I was scared to death. And I didn't know what to do. And I asked God, I said, God, just show us how to walk through this, because I don't know how. God started surrounding us with people in the program. You are our family. You are our family. And I picked up the phone, and I called my sponsor. And she said, I'll be right there. And so she drove an hour and a half to meet me. And long story short, he did not survive. And the day before his funeral, I had my children had come in. He had a son from a previous marriage. I don't think I mentioned that. So he had come in. My daughter had come in. They were staying at the house. And I couldn't sleep. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor. Thank God for those sponsors that answer the phone at any hour of the day or night. Because when we need them, we need them. We need them desperately. And she told me, she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to come over. She said, come on over. I'll have the coffee ready when you get here. So I drove over there, and she has a prayer garden out in her backyard. And we went out there in that prayer garden, and we started praying. And I hurt so bad, I thought I was going to lose my mind. I don't know if any of y'all have ever hurt that bad or not, but I hurt so bad, I actually thought I was fixing to go insane. And it was at that point, I felt these loving arms of a God who I do understand to the best of my human ability wrap his arms around me. He said, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Through a loving and caring God, the 12 steps of AA and Al-Anon and these fellowships, I made it through that. So, shortly, and after Dick died, I had five different women, one from Florida, one from Alabama, one from Georgia, one from Texas, maybe it was four, not five, four. Each one of them called me and they said, Ronell, because I had to take care of him those 10 months, and they called me and they said, Ronell, you've been through a lot. Come stay with me and let me take care of you. And I went and stayed with each one of them for a week. And they cared for me. And one of the greatest gifts that they gave me was to allow me to talk about it. Not have to fix it. Not have to make it okay. would allow me to get it out so that my healing could begin. And you know, isn't that what we do in our fifth steps? We talk about it. We talk about our pains, our hurts, our shame, our guilt. We talk about it because it's through the talking and the sharing, the understanding and love of another human being who I call God with skin on in those situations, allows us the opportunity to heal. Shortly after that, Mr. Mike started showing up at my house. And he wanted to help me do the yard work. And I know today that he did that out of his love for Doc, or Dickie, and his concern for me. And so as he shared last night, he would do this, and I didn't really want him to. I just wanted him to show me how to use the equipment, and I could do it. You know, at Al-Anon, we can do it. You know, show me how I can do it.
Right.
And he would come up, but he would not show me. He would just do it. And I kept telling him, you cannot be doing this. You cannot work 40 hours a week, keep up your house, and come up here and do my yard work. You just can't do that. You know, and but he kept on. And so we did go to dinner that night that he asked me to go with him. And we're on our way over there, and we're in his truck. And so he starts this conversation, and it went something like this. You know, this is a farm truck. No, I just thought it was a truck you rode back and forth to work with, but okay, it's a farm truck. And he said, you know, you don't have to wear seat belts in a farm truck. And I looked at him and I said, well, let me back up. A little bit earlier, he had said, this kind of feels like a date and I'm uncomfortable. And I said, well, I was too, because it had been a long time since I'd gone on any kind of date. And so he starts talking about this farm truck and you don't have to wear seat belts. And I looked at him and I said, the last time I dated, they didn't even have seatbelt laws. So, anyway, things progressed, and Mike did ask me to marry him. We did get married. We went out to the Grand Tetons, one of my favorite places, underneath those snow-capped, majestic mountains, and we said our I do's. And we came back. And now I want to say, before I said that I do, you know, that guy I lived with for a while that had the Corvette and all that, but the house was for sale, no furniture. You know, I didn't have high standards then. And, of course, when I met Dickie, I forgot to tell y'all this, he was unemployed. He did not have a vehicle or any means of transportation other than his feet. He was drawing unemployment from the state of California, and he wasn't working. It didn't matter. You see, he had told me, I love you. So when Mike came rolling around, I'd been in recovery a few 24 hours. I had standards. He had to be fully self-supporting by his own voluntary contributions. He could not be married. He needed to have a spiritual program and practice it. He could not smoke. He could not drink. And if he had children, they had to be grown. He met all those qualifications. He didn't even have children. So, anyway, Mike and I started building our life together, and it has been a wonderful life together. Thank you, darling. I appreciate it. He's been good to me. He has been truly, truly good to me. But we have had our differences. And one of them, it goes back to one of my character defects, and this is one I had to deal with, and this is that one of where I like to play God. And when I like to play God, what I like to do is protect those that I love. And Mike and I got married within a year of Dick's death. So I had a problem there. And my problem was that I had not finished my grieving process. And it's hard when you're grieving for one to fall in love with another. Because within, there's a conflict. Because there's unresolved issues there. And I was trying to protect Mike from this because I didn't want him to know that I was having that kind of conflict. And but he sensed it. He knew something was wrong, but he didn't know what it was. And, of course, he thought it was him. Because that's kind of how this disease works. And so I went to a women's retreat, and it's of AA and Al-Anon women, and my sponsor was there. And they had this thing, it's called a whisper walk. And it was during this whisper walk that God spoke to me. You see, Mike and I had had a big argument. And I had told Mike, I said, Mike, I said, I've only got half a heart. I said, when Dick died, I sealed off that part of my heart, and it will always belong to him. So I only have a half a heart left to give. Now, this gentle, loving man told me, he said, a half a heart from you is more than enough for me. So I'm at this retreat, and I'm trying to deal with all of this. And so what I heard on this whisper walk was, love someone with all your heart. That was God telling me it was okay for me to love again. It was okay. So I'm out in Arkansas, and I call Mike, and I tell him I'm on my way home. And I said, when I get home, I said, we need to talk. You wanna watch an alcoholic squirm in their seat? Just tell him we need to talk. So he had to wait 2 days for me to get back home. And I get back home, and we sit down in the living room, and I said, we need to talk. He's like, okay. And so I told him what had happened. I told him that I could now love with all my heart. And he just stood up and grabbed me in his arms and just held me. God will heal us of whatever our hurt is, however deep it is, however painful it is. God can heal us of that if we will but surrender to his will. We have a good marriage today. We have a good marriage. And I am so honored and so privileged to be loved by such a gentle and strong man. And I thank you, because it is only because of these programs of AA and Al-Anon that we can have these promises today. I love each and every one of you. Have a wonderful weekend.